I've been talking about the nature of the community as Luke presents it, but and also the kind of ministers that you see in the early church. And I like to look at Acts 20. One of the problems I think, and I'm not preaching, by the way, I'm really kind of working, trying to teach through the text in some ways, but I've not heard Acts preached very often. And I was talking to Dr. Gregory about this, and sometimes because it's the passages are so long narratives, we don't know what to do with them. Last Sunday, I was in West Texas, and Sunday night, I tried to preach through Acts 27 through 28, the shipwreck passage, which it takes you half the night to read through the whole passage. And then I was also told by another one of my colleagues, Dr. Arterberry, that a lot of people have the problems with the miracles. It's all right for Jesus to do these kinds of things, but for the apostles to do these kinds of things creates some problems. But what I'd like to do is look at, this is a long passage, Acts 20, 13 to 38, one of these long passages, Paul's speech to the Ephesian elders at Miletus. And I'd just like to pick out some characteristics here that I think are representative of the kinds of ministers that make the church effective. And just in verse 19, he talks about serving the Lord with all humility. And I think this is something you see very prominent in the letter to the Philippians. And humility is clearly to be distinguished from an inferiority complex. But the humble person does not seek external honor, public esteem, willing to accept a lower position, lesser regard. And that virtue was not a virtue in the Greco-Roman culture. Aristotle says it's easy to outdo the lowly. And Paul would probably respond, well, let them outdo you and rejoice in their success in the Lord. We have one professor who here on our faculty, and I don't want to mention his name to embarrass him, but Dr. Olson says, I am so humble I have to pray for pride every day. Martin Luther said, true humility never knows that it is humble. And I think pride and self-involvement are perennial issues for ministers who, like politicians, grow accustomed to hearing the sound of their own voices saying important things. And they can also grow accustomed to the deference of the flock. And the danger of pride, as Raymond Brown said, is that the proud don't look that they look down on others because they don't look up to God. And so the emphasis is Paul serves the Lord with all humility. He also says, verse right after this, and with tears. Jonathan Swift said, when a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign. The dunces are all in a confederacy against him. And there is a confederacy of dunces against Paul if you were to read his letters. And he talks about the tears, particularly in 2 Corinthians. I wrote you out of much distress and anguish of heart with many tears. And you read it in Philippians when he talks about, he gives thanks for the recovery of Epaphroditus. God had mercy on him, not only on him, but also me, that I might not have grief upon grief, sorrow after sorrow. And the reality is most congregations are not chock full of Barnabases who are encouraging you all the time. There is an abundance of high maintenance saints who can become like thorns in the flesh and pains in all the wrong places. And for all its rewards, the work of ministry can be discouraging. Ministers like Paul go live through the dark night of the soul, experience the darkness because of the challenges of their congregations, experience darkness because of emotional depression, experience darkness because of physical or spiritual fatigue. And Jeremiah says, tell me about it. May I just kind of riff off on Jeremiah and Paul, because we heard about Jeremiah last night. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, for necessity is laid upon me, for woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. Jeremiah, I may be misinterpreting, but Jeremiah, I think, says, woe is me for ever having been born to have to preach this lousy message. Paul says, woe is me if I do not preach. I'm compelled to do it. I'm doomed if I don't. Paul knows his Bible. Paul knows Jeremiah. He describes his call in exactly the same way that Jeremiah did. Jeremiah 1:5, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you to be a prophet to the nations. You can hear Jeremiah whispering in Paul's text. They are singing together, but it's in harmony. Paul has a different take on ministry. It's the same God that has got you, the same burning in the gut, the same kind of heartache. It's with tears, but it's a different take. Woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. He then says, enduring trials that came to me through the plots of the Jews. Some endure trials from external pressures, brutal trials. And Paul said, I mentioned this last night in 2 Corinthians 11, five times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. And Paul is talking about this, the synagogue discipline of scourging, which Jesus warned us about. Be on your guard against persons. They will hand you over to the local councils. They will flog you in the synagogues. And Paul himself may have been one to inflict this punishment on Christians before his conversion and his call. The number of lashes prescribed depending on the severity of the crime, and 40 lashes, according to Deuteronomy 25, are the maximum number. The maximum number that can be given before the punishment degenerates into cruel humiliation. Moses had a high tolerance, apparently, for cruel humiliation. And despite the concern in Deuteronomy that your neighbor not be degraded in your sight, the ancient Jewish historian Josephus regarded flogging as a most disgraceful penalty. Now, I find the rabbinic literature important for interpreting the New Testament. And I remember vividly reading through the Mishnaic tractate, Makot, which means stripes, that deals with the 40 lashes, the Deuteronomy 25, 1-3 passage. It lists the crimes deserving scourging and the manner in which they are to be given. And that 40 lashes was reduced to 39, perhaps as a precaution of losing count, going over the number prescribed. But they, in the Mishnah, the number of lashes is to be divided by three. Maybe because they used a scourge with three thongs, and 13 lashes would be the equivalent of 39. If it reflects first century practice, then the victim was stripped, bound to a pillar. One third of the stripes are administered on the front, the rest on the back, while an attendant repeatedly recited Deuteronomy 28, 58 to 59. If you do not carefully follow all the words of this law which are written in this book and do not revere this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God, the Lord will send fearful plagues on you and your descendants, harsh and prolonged disasters, severe and lingering illnesses. Paul cited this text in Galatians 3:10 to support the point that those who rely on the law are under the law's curse. I don't know why the synagogue inflicted this punishment on Paul, but I suspect it was blasphemy. According to the Mishnah, there are 36 sins, including blasphemy, that warranted being cut off from the people. And I guess that Paul was subjected to this penalty because of the serious sin, the blasphemy of proclaiming his faith in Christ, his altered understanding of Judaism, the inclusion of Gentiles in the people of God. But I'll never forget when I was reading through this tractate in the Mishnah and came across this line, Makot 3:15. When he is scourged, then he is thy brother. When he is scourged, then he is thy brother. Flogging averted both a harsher punishment at the hand of God, and it averted being cut off from the people. And this may clarify what Paul says when he writes, to the Jews I became as a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not under the law myself, to win those under the law. He allowed the synagogue to administer punishment like this to him in order to maintain his relationship with the synagogue. To submit to this punishment 5 times testifies not only to his physical stamina, but to his commitment to his people, which he proclaims in Romans 9, I have great sorrow, unceasing anguish in my heart, for I could wish myself that I myself were cursed and were cut off from Christ, that my brothers, my own people, might be saved. I guarantee you, that's not my spirit. You treat me, you just look funny at me, I'm gone. He submitted to this 5 times. Would not let go. That's why he kept putting up with the Corinthians, I guess. But then he says he didn't shrink. I guess, and I'm going to cut this short, when people need a root canal, Paul was not someone to give them a gum massage instead. He says, I coveted no one's silver or gold. Corinthians had trouble with this. They considered it demeaning for him to work. Paul did accept money. He didn't accept money from the churches in which he was currently working, because as he had this overwhelming sense of God's gracious offer of forgiveness, salvation was given freely, and he professed himself to be Christ's slave, not Christ's hired hand. He understood that God did not use a free enterprise system in offering the salvation to the world. God does not say, you can have the gospel if you pay for it. In our world, everything has a price, and the MasterCard commercial would say the gospel is priceless. There's no money, no monetary value that can be attached to it, therefore it's free. And Gordon Fee says, it reflects a divine economy. You receive from God what you do not have, cannot get for yourself. And then you're expected to give it to someone else who has no means to repay you and can't get it anywhere else. I worry that in our world, religion has become a mass market commodity. I see churches vying with one another, trying to offer more exciting music, more uplifting messages. Some of them, I think, are just trying to pass themselves off as a Lonely Hearts Club gathering. I mean, I hear quotes. They're making their pitches. Come, let us love you. Or here's a direct quote, a church where no stranger need feel strangely. Or a church where everybody is special. They're selling themselves to the public as if they're commodities and pass off Christianity as something that enhances the quality and enjoyment of life and not something to glorify God. And the pastors who are good at this commodity business get awarded commensurately. And how often is that which we hail as a successful ministry little more than success in winning a personal following? They become the sage on stage. They put on their super pastor capes, and they believe they're worth every penny they're paid and far more. And many want to be just like them. Lutheran Bishop Mark Hansen wrote this, and I conclude. Pastors feel incredible pressure to get and retain their market share in a very competitive, consumer-oriented religious culture. So they flock to hear the techniques of the most successful pastors. However helpful such presentations are, my experience is that they seldom invite one into the wonder of God's grace that causes us to ask questions that transcend the moment. They fail to drive me to the cross or to the paradoxical truth that this is where the hidden God reveals God's self as the gracious and merciful one who died for you, who died for me, and for the whole creation. Those are the kinds of ministers you see in Acts.